From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Governor Charlie Baker is sworn in for a second term, striking a markedly different tone than the one in Washington.
Let others engage in the cheap shots and the low blows. Let's make our brand of politics positive and optimistic instead of cruel and dark.
Also today, the state's minimum wage hike is a win for workers, but critics say it can have unintended consequences.
People who may be receiving pay increases, they'll also be paying more money for goods and services because at some point a business will have to raise their prices to pay for all these labor cost increases.
And a new TV show uses modern science to re-examine an old mystery, the Lizzie Borden murders.
New evidence indicates Lizzie may be innocent.
So who killed the Bordens?
The sister? The uncle? The maid? Or someone else entirely?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, marking the day when Charlie Baker's second term as governor officially begins. Often called the country's most popular governor, Baker was sworn in this afternoon, and he used that opportunity to reflect on the years behind and those ahead.
Thanks to the hard work of so many, I can say with complete confidence that the state of our Commonwealth is strong. Thank you.
Here with me to discuss the governor's words and his plans is WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks. How you doing, Anthony?
Hey, Evan. Well, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm doing pretty nice to see you in here.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Let's talk about the speech. What jumped out at you?
Well, you know, if you're looking for the sort of big, bold idea that would define Charlie Baker's second term, you might have come away from this speech disappointed. On the other hand, this was vintage Charlie Baker. It was a practical to-do list, not a big, bold vision thing list. He took credit for progress in his first term on things like the economy, more people working in Massachusetts than ever before, education spending up, he's fixing the T, the opioid crisis is still a crisis, but there are signs that fewer people are dying. And Baker makes the point that slow and steady wins the race. I want you to listen to something. Here's a bit of what he said.
I want you to think about the Commonwealth's leadership on national issues. We have the highest rate of health care coverage in the nation. But that story was written across 2 decades, 10 legislative sessions, 5 governors, and 4 presidents. We have best-in-the-nation gun laws, a story that was also written across multiple legislative sessions and several governors, and was almost always done on a bipartisan basis.
So, Evan, what I like about that is there's a kind of modesty there. You know, there isn't like this guy who's saying, I've got the big idea. I'm going to change, I'm going to rock your world. It's like slow and steady wins the race. And maybe the big idea is that there isn't a big idea beyond competence, working incrementally with a Democratic legislature and burnishing that image of an extremely competent, get-down-in-the-weeds governor who avoids deep ideological fights.
And I mean, it's interesting that you picked out that clip. It stood out to me, too, because it speaks not just to a kind of modesty, but to a kind of gradualism that makes some sense of his incrementalist approach. It's like, I'm part of this longer-term process of making the Commonwealth a better place, and I don't have to take credit for every little thing. I want to be part of a bigger thing. I mean, what are the bigger things? So looking ahead, what are the bigger things he wants to be part of?
Well, really more of the same. Steady as she goes, he talked about continuing progress on transportation, bringing health care costs down, the opioid crisis, as we mentioned, more but modest investments in education, redoubling his commitment to more housing in the state, and making a big commitment to clean energy, really building on some of the big things that he focused on his first during his first 4 years.
You believe it? That is, I mean, how you listen to it and you think, how realistic do the plans sound?
Oh, I think they're realistic, maybe not fully fleshed out. For example, one thing stuck out to me. He talked about the need for more housing. He says we need to get this done, but how's he going to get it done? In his first term, he filed a bill that tried to spur more housing construction by giving local communities more flexibility with zoning. But it died in the legislature, and he said today we shouldn't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. So does this mean he's going to refile the same bill, or does he have something bigger and bolder in mind? It's not clear. On the other hand, State of the Union inaugural addresses, this was also a State of the Union address, aren't really designed to get to specifics.
Well, it's not a policy speech.
Right.
He's giving a general sense for the State of the Commonwealth.
So I have something. So he also spent a lot of time, as I mentioned, talking about his accomplishments in the first term, particularly when it comes to the economy. More people working in Massachusetts than ever before. And I have a clip here, Evan, that I want to play for you where he talked about something else. Here it is.
Massachusetts no longer has a structural budget deficit. With your help, we ended last year with a major budget surplus, deposited over $650 million into the stabilization fund, and anticipate making another major deposit to that fund at the end of this year.
Now, Evan, forgive me. I know you're the host, but you're the numbers guy. So I want to ask you about this question. He often takes credit, Charlie Baker does, for reducing or eliminating the structural budget deficit. He got a big hand in the legislature today, mostly from Democrats. What's he talking about?
So and what do you make first? Like, you have a real knack for picking out the clips that I want to talk about and want to hear again. Yeah, I jumped out at me because, I mean, structural budget deficit is one of those things that who understands? The idea is, like, when the economy is so-so, does the state run a deficit or a surplus?
Right.
And when the economy is so-so, we should be close to neutral. What he's taking credit for just strikes me as slightly off.
Because?
Yeah. Because it's true that we did have a surplus, or we did seem to end the year with a surplus, but the economy is not so-so. It's really, really good. It's the best it's been in a long time, and he knows that. That's a big reason we ended with a surplus. We also had a major tax cut, corporate tax cut, which seems to have boosted tax revenues last year, which also played a part. So I don't think you can rightly claim or necessarily demonstrate that he has fixed the structural budget deficit, even though we had a good year.
And it raises the question, the issue of what happens if we have a few bad years.
Well, I think that's a big question. Don't you think that's a big question for
Absolutely.
His legacy?
Yeah, really interesting. So another thing I want to mention about his speech, though, is it's striking, just what a bubble we live in Massachusetts. I mean, here we are living with a government shutdown, terrible political divisions in Washington, a chief executive who doesn't seem to really be interested in working with the opposition party. Yet in Massachusetts, we've got a Republican governor, deep blue Massachusetts, this great working relationship with a Democratic legislature. And Charlie Baker's tone stands in such contrast to that. Here's what he said toward the end of his speech.
Let others engage in the cheap shots and the low blows. Let's make our brand of politics positive and optimistic instead of cruel and dark. And instead of the bickering and the name-calling that dominates much of today's public debate, let's build on the work of those who came before us and make our work about how we can make this state better for the people who call this glorious place home.
So he didn't say the name Donald Trump, but
but it's there, right?
It's there,
strewn through there,
and it's a really interesting sort of moment, when a guy like Charlie Baker stands out in such a striking contrast to someone like Trump, and has created a political mood, I guess you could say, in this state that is so different than the one that dominates so much of this country right now.
Well, that's WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
But we're not done with the governor's speech. I want to dig into one of the issues that the governor mentioned, an issue I know is on a lot of listeners' minds, that is transportation. And that includes the roads, the T, the traffic, and the simple-sounding question of what we can do to make travel smoother and more environmentally sustainable. So joining us in studio to discuss is Jim Alesi, former transportation secretary, member of the Transit Matters Board, and the principal of TriMount Consulting. Jim, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me back, Evan.
Anytime. Also with us is Carolyn Ryan. She's Senior Vice President for Policy and Research at the Boston Chamber of Commerce. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Well, so listeners, we also want you to join this conversation. How would you rate Governor Baker thus far on transportation? Well, what do you make of the work that's been done on the T and the streets? What do you think needs to be our top priority or his top priority to fix and improve in a second term? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston, and we'll get to your questions as soon as you call in. But let's start with the people actually in the room. Jim, before we talk about the future, how about the past, the first term? What's your sense for the governor's record, his accomplishments thus far when it comes to transportation?
I think he has some real accomplishments. I think his appointments particularly to the MBTA's Fiscal Management and Control Board, have been...
Which he essentially created.
He created. There are many people, myself included, who were skeptical about creating a new board, but his appointments have been outstanding. The work that that board has done has borne fruit. He's appointed a solid secretary. We don't always agree on everything, but his appointments, I think, have been both strong and important to rebuilding confidence. That's been a good thing. I think toward the end of this first term, we've seen some things happen that are really hopeful. The governor's embrace of a cap and invest program that will both reduce emissions and raise revenue for transportation. The governor's future transportation commission that really sets the table for a future of sustainable mobility.
So we're tripping from first term to second, because these are things but they're planning
correct
for future
and I think
implementation.
In terms of the first term, there were things that were done, you know, I would say to get the T back on track, some decisions that the Fiscal Management Control Board made, like spending another several hundred million dollars to complete all new red line trains by 2023, good decisions. A lot wasn't done. A lot needs to be done. So in sort of setting a grade for this, it's still incomplete. I think the complete grade comes at the end of the second term.
Carolyn, incomplete?
No. You know, I think I would give them a solid B, recognizing that a solid A means we would have a world-class transportation system in the Commonwealth.
That's quite a curve you've established. Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, we don't have that, and I don't think anybody thinks we have that, especially when it comes to our public transit. But they've made a lot of good progress. And one of the important things this administration has done, and this, the control board, is they've built back up or started to build back up the public trust and confidence in the system by addressing some of the more egregious operational issues and challenges and acknowledging the steep climb on the capital investments that we need, things like our signals and our systems. And they're very you know, unglamorous types of investments, but there are things that need to happen. So I think in terms of building up that trust and building up the political capital to hopefully do something going big going forward, I think they've done a good job.
So if you were the governor, Carolyn, and you had that, you built up that political capital for 4 years, and now you're planning to spend it, where do you spend it?
I think what is missing a little bit is a big, bold vision on transportation. That's what we'd like to see. That includes taking all of these different projects that we have out there floating around and figuring out which ones are going to move us ahead in terms of supporting economic growth. They might address some of our housing crisis. They take into account climate change and the effects of that. Figuring out how much all of those cost and whether we need revenues, and if we do, how much and what those look like. I think that's the next step that we'd like to see going into the next term.
Jim, you agree?
So let's think about what the most serious transportation problem is as we speak today.
What is it?
It's congestion. Congestion is polluting our air. We're losing
congestion
money.
Congestion on the streets, congestion
congestion in the urban core, congestion on the interstate highway system, congestion on local roads. We've got to deal with this issue, and it's different depending on where you are. The whole point of sustainable mobility is to have get people access to key destinations conveniently and safely. That means jobs, healthcare, education, et cetera. We can decongest the system, but we've got to act. In the urban core, for example, East Boston is choking on traffic congestion because the explosion of Uber and Lyft cars into Logan is uncontrollable. We have to commit, I would ask the Baker administration to consider, connecting the red and the blue line so that people in Kendall Square don't need to take an Uber to the airport but can hop on a very easy transit connection. Number one, we can decongest the interstates if we commit to a regional rail vision that is an electrified inner city system with frequent all-day service. Now, the governor, to his credit, the secretary put together a regional rail visioning plan. I'm on the council. That report will be issued at the end of this year. But we need to commit the dollars to begin a transformation of what we call commuter rail to something that is truly frequent all-day electrified speedier intercity rail.
So I want to say again that we're eager to hear your views on this, listeners. Just give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. And let's go to Steve from Marshfield. He's got a plan he likes. Steve, what do you recommend?
Yes, thanks for taking me a call. I'm calling in support of the North-South Station Rail Link. Instead of taking valuable urban land and using it to store and shunt passenger equipment, they ought to connect the two stations, as Governors Weld and Dukakis recommend, and have run-through systems so that people like me in Marshfield can take a job up in Salem and go straight through with a single-seat ride. That also improves the connection from the Northeast Corridor with Amtrak to northeastern New England, and it would promote an all-electric system for both commuter rail as well as Amtrak.
Wow, Steve, thank you so much for coming. It sounds like Steve has really studied this issue and communicated with the former governors, who have come out pretty vociferously in favor of this plan. Carolyn, what's your take on the North-South Rail Link? What does it mean? I mean, the idea, just so listeners know, a tunnel connecting North Station and South Station so you can allow traffic to run across different parts of what is now a disconnected rail system.
Right. It's a project, when you talk about just that project, makes a ton of sense. This gets back to my earlier point. We have a lot of projects, when you're only talking about that project, make a ton of sense. But somebody else said this, there's not enough money in the Commonwealth to pay for all of those projects, let alone what we actually have in terms of tax revenue and other revenues to spend on it. So we have to think about all of these relative to each other. And how does an investment in North-South Rail Link compare to an investment on a Blue Line, Red Line connector, on South Station expansion, all of these other things? Does it help us achieve overall economic and policy goals for the state and the city?
Well, does it?
I don't know. That's what we need.
So a study of the cost-benefit analysis of various operations. It's not just a matter of cost, right, Jim? There's a capacity issue, too. How many big projects can the MBTA or MassDOT oversee at any one time?
Well, as many as they have the resources for. I mean, the real issue, when people like me call for more net new revenue for the MBTA, it's to get them the resources to do more. When the Green Line extension was in trouble, the MBTA brought in resources from other places and paid them well to keep that project on track, no pun intended. So we need the resources to get, you know, the secretary issued a report to her credit that showed that connecting the Red and the Blue Line was a lot less expensive than people thought. So there are resources are there to move in that direction. We have to, you know, we can't be stuck in this. We know the cost of everything and the value of nothing. The importance of mobility to keeping our economy going is critical. And so we need to find those resources and we need to do better. Look, the governor in his remarks today said we need to invest in the future of zero emission technology. That means things like electric vehicle infrastructure, et cetera. I'm all for it. Today's paper tells us that the city and the state can't even figure out how to paint, who's going to pay for the paint on dedicated bus lanes. Well, let me just say to everyone listening, if we can't figure that out, we're never going to get out of our own way to get to a zero-emission transportation system. We've got to do better.
Well, in his speech today, the governor did say that there are big plans to spend billions of dollars on infrastructure. Let's listen to that.
Over the course of the next 5 years, the T plans to spend over $8 billion on infrastructure, much of which will be invested in its core system. This is more than twice what has ever been spent by the T in any five-year period of time. Now, this will be no small task.
Well, now, that's quite a claim. More than twice as much as has ever been spent. Carolyn, what do you make of this claim? Are we really spending at unprecedented levels?
I think that $8 billion includes some of the investments in the Orange and Red Line car upgrades. It includes some of the Green Line expansion. So those are major projects. We haven't had new Orange and Red Line cars in decades. So yes, those are significant investments that we need in the core system. I think some of what I would focus in on that is it's the core system. And we certainly need that running well. But Boston is also the population's increased. We've grown as a city. And is the core system adequate to meet our needs? And based on our congestion issues, I don't know if that's true anymore.
Hmm. We have another suggestion from George in Newburyport. George, what do you think should be a top priority for fixing transit?
Well, I really do appreciate the comments that the gentlemen have been making about the connecting north-south, et cetera. But what I would say to summarize, or the point I would make, is that we should not fail to make some smaller changes that would make a big psychological impact at the same time. Things like connecting the T subway line with the commuter rail in Revere. You know, that the tracks run right beside each other. People for a long time have said that would be a great way to get to the airport from the North Shore. And no one seems to be touching that. Similarly, the commuter bus has real nice parking rides, but the train, commuter rail, you have to pay $4 a day for parking, which adds up. So these are small things. I would just make those suggestions. Let's look for those.
It's a great point, George. Focus on the small things. And you're not the only one with this idea. Marjorie from Watertown has a similar thought on, you know, making the small things big things. Marjorie, what was your idea?
My idea is that we should have better signage in our area. You can go down the street and there's no sign telling you what street you're on. You can go down the street and suddenly find you're in a left turn lane or a right turn lane. People respond to that by poking along. I think if they had a better idea of where they were and what lane to be in, it would help a lot. It certainly is not going to solve all the problems. But
sometimes little things add up. Thank you so much, Marjorie. Jim, so what do you make of the broader idea that a lot of little things could make a difference?
I think it's an important idea. Transit Matters, you know, serve on their board. We believe in lower cost, higher impact solutions. You know, when I was Secretary of Transportation, we inaugurated the Silver Line 4 service for $1.7 million to replace a projected $2.1 billion subway tunnel that wasn't feasible. So, yes, those of us who call for net new revenue and more resources are not asking or calling for profligate spending. Let me make that clear.
All right.
We are asking for levels of investment that match our need. Metro Boston, which is basically the MBTA service area, produces 84% of the state's gross domestic product. We need the transit system that supports that economy and that GDP has to function better than it has been functioning. And so when the governor says today, you know, $8 billion over 5 years, that's $1.6 billion a year. And as Carolyn points out, that includes new red line, new orange line, new green line extension. When you pull all that out, not that that's not important, but when you pull it out, not really a lot of investment going into what we all believe needs to happen. And so we support the Future Commission vision and the governor's belief, as he said, that he needs to step up investment in public transportation. But, you know, it's like King Claudius in Hamlet. My words rise up and my thoughts lie below. Words without action are just words. And so what we need to do is support the governor, the legislature, to raise the net new revenue that needs to be raised. And one last thing I want to say, we need to empower cities and towns. And I'm looking forward to the legislature handing the governor a regional ballot initiative act to sign into law this year that will bring true regional equity into Massachusetts, allowing cities and towns to put ballot questions before the voters to raise local fees or taxes to support local infrastructure needs. Other places do this very successfully. We need to begin to do that in Massachusetts, both to support regional equity and to get new revenue in to support the kind of investment that we know we need.
Yeah. And in the meantime, while we're talking about investing for the future and future plans, there's this turnover in management at the MBTA, right? We had GM, who in place for 15 months, suddenly gone. We have Steve Poftak taking over. What do you make of this, Carolyn? Is this a sign of disarray? Is it an improvement? What happened?
You know, I don't know for sure what happened. It's certainly a tough job, and that could be part of it. I think having Steve Poftak in there, somebody who knows what he's getting into pretty clearly.
Steve's been on the control board.
He's been on the control board, yes. He's been in the area for a long time. You know, that was some of what we heard with the most recent departure. That could be helpful to this, but I think that's an important point, is the disruption in leadership creates a bit of instability for the however many thousands of people are working at the T, and they do need that level of stability, particularly when they're coming under increased scrutiny over the last few years in terms of its operations being a priority for the governor.
Yeah, and also, right, because the governor has made effective bureaucratic control, operational reform at the agency, such a top priority. To see this change at the top, did it surprise you, Jim? Did you see
no,
it coming?
Yes, it did not surprise me.
You did see it,
and you know, we all know, many of us in this arena know Steve Poftak. He's going to be, I believe, a strong and stable leader at the T. I'm hoping that Steve raises his comfort level about looking at net new revenue and pushing the envelope. The T needs to innovate, and you need to take risk when you innovate, and the leader of the organization needs to let everyone know that if they do take reasonable risk and innovate, that he's got their back.
Now, just to switch from transit to the roads, you mentioned this already, Jim, but there is talk now of a kind of cap and trade system for car emissions.
Cap and invest, correct.
Okay, cap and invest system for car emissions. This is going to happen over the next year? That is, there would be some kind of tax, equivalent to a tax on emissions, where there's a limit to what you can emit. And what is your sense for this plan? Is it going to happen? Is it a good idea?
I think it's going to happen. I think the governors are pretty much in line. And I think with the inauguration of Janet Mills in Maine yesterday, even more governors will join in. On this RGGI for transportation. It's been happening in California and elsewhere, where we're basically putting a cost on carbon emissions. We're saying to the wholesaler, you pay a fee based on a certain formula.
That is, we already do this at power plants.
We already do this at power plants. We know that in that context, it worked quite successfully. In this context, it's designed really... it will raise the price of gasoline. There's no question about that.
Which is part of the
point. Well, and it's going to raise net new revenue for Massachusetts. But it's also going, I think, to reduce people's use of vehicles and reduce emissions. So it's designed to do both.
Well, Carolyn.
Well, part of the pushback you'll hear from the business community and others when we talk not just about this as a form of new revenue, but any new revenue, is we have to know how it's going to be spent first.
I agree with that.
And that's why I talked earlier about this list and knowing what our priority projects are. I think there's a lot of discomfort with an idea of just sort of giving a blank revenue source and not having a clear vision for what we're going to get for
that. But you think the business, I mean, from what you hear as, you know, working in the chamber, there might be an appetite for increasing revenue through a tax or system like that if it were earmarked in some way towards transportation
investment. I think it would have to be more than earmarked. It couldn't just say it's going to go into a transportation fund.
Oh, wow. More concrete than that.
Yeah, you know, listen, businesses understand what a major problem is transportation is in our region. Their employees can't get to work. They can't get home easily. Nobody wants that. They understand the need for investment. But... again, they don't want just a blank check written. Even if it is earmarked specifically for transportation, that's, I don't think, adequate. I think there needs to be more specifics around it. And something that takes into account statewide equity. So it can't, as much as we'd like it to just be maybe a Boston investment.
It has to be sensitive to the fact that not everybody lives in Boston or Greater Boston.
Right.
Well, that's Carolyn Ryan, Senior Vice President for Policy and Research at the Boston Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you.
And also with us was Jim Aloisi, former Transportation Secretary, member of the Transit Matters Board, principal of Trimount Consulting. I could go on, but I'll just thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Evan.
stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Tens of thousands of Massachusetts workers are getting a raise this week, thanks to a jump in the state's minimum wage from $11 an hour to $12 an hour. Over the next 4 years, that wage is going to rise all the way to $15 an hour, which is considered a big victory for workers and labor advocates. But some employers, including small business owners, are worried that they can't afford to pay these higher wages. Here with us to talk about that is Christopher Carlozzi, who's the Massachusetts State Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which represents more than 5,000 businesses statewide. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Good to be here today.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And I want to hear your thoughts. I mean, what are the concerns? Wait, so there's a minimum wage increase. It's, I would say the first, but we've been doing this for a couple of years. We've gone from 8 to 11, moving up to 12 and up to 15. What kinds of concerns does this raise for businesses, for small businesses in particular?
At FIB, we represent the smaller business. It's usually roughly about 5 workers for these businesses, so it's the smallest of the
small. So very small.
That's correct.
And there's like a lot restaurants, salons, spa.
Retail shops. It's going to impact a lot of people. And for my members, there's a lot of fear out there. They're saying to themselves, how do I pay for this? That's the question I'm getting the most. How am I supposed to afford all these cost increases? Because while minimum wage is just part of the equation, there are other factors as well as driving costs for small businesses right now. And if you remember, this was part of a package called the Grand Bargain Law.
So this is over last summer, right?
That's correct.
The lawmakers came together to stop a couple of ballot initiatives by coming to an agreement.
And what happened is this went forward as a package, which included a paid family medical leave program that's going to start going into effect in July of this year and can be utilized later on in time in 2021. But small businesses have been facing double-digit premium increases for health care. Recently as a little while ago, the governor in his comments earlier today was talking about how Massachusetts small businesses face the second highest health care costs in the nation. They face some of the highest energy costs. So this is just one more added labor cost for them. And they're sitting back saying, how am I going to afford this? My sales are not matching these labor cost increases.
Now, I mean, one reason it was a grand compromise is because business groups got something out of it too, a guarantee that there would be a tax holiday, right?
That's correct. And for my members, grand bargain was kind of a false term. A lot of them call it a grand mitigation. So it wasn't as bad as
they were worried that it would have been worse had it gone to the ballot.
It certainly would have been a faster increase. It would have been over 4 years rather than the 5 years. And there were some benefits for retailers in particular, which was the phase out of our premium Sunday holiday pay. Retail shops of 7 or more had to pay.
You have to pay time and a half, right?
Correct. On Sundays and some certain holidays. And this was included in that package, and it was a gradual ratchet down over a 5-year period, and it phases out in 2023. And part of the reason, under a $15 minimum wage, small businesses would have been facing a $22.50 an hour Sunday pay or holiday pay. And really,
right, because that's time and a half. 15 times 1.5 gets you $22.50
an hour on a Sunday or a holiday. And that just wasn't realistic. I could count on one hand how many small businesses would stay open on a Sunday or a holiday if that were the case.
Right. Because, I mean, for people who don't own their own businesses, you got to think through the logic. If the employee is not helping you bring in an additional $22.50 in sales on a Sunday, then it's not worth having them there.
That's correct. If sales are not increasing with labor costs, certain things are going to have to give at a certain point. And you can only charge so much for a product or a service without seeing a reduction in people buying things or going to a restaurant as often.
So, no, at the same time, we did see a big tax cut last year that included substantial tax cuts for corporations, though most of your businesses wouldn't qualify as corporations, but also for pass-through businesses. Presumably, that's a big boon for a lot of the businesses you represent.
The federal tax cuts did help a lot of small businesses in the state, but I don't think some of these increased labor costs. I mean, we had, in 2014, a mandatory paid sick leave law went into effect. Well, 2015, it went into effect. It passed in 14 on the ballot. That was a cost of doing business increase, and that was something that cost a lot of small businesses in particular. And then we just keep adding these on yearly. There's something called the EMAC assessment or EMAC tax or mass health tax, whatever you want to call it, that went into effect in 2017, where a lot of small businesses are now being assessed a fee on any employee that may receive subsidized health care, state subsidized health care. So all these things just add up for small businesses.
That's if they don't provide health care for
their
employees.
That's correct. What you see is a lot of small businesses may have somebody who takes on a secondary job, someone who works a weekend job. You have a lot of kids working, younger folks. So small businesses are often the kind of community place where people hire the local kids or somebody who wants that job during the day, maybe while their kids are in school. And so if somebody, you know, is receiving the subsidized care, they're responsible for this EMAC assessment. So it's almost like everything is just piling up at once. If it was one or two things, it would be easier for them to absorb. But it's just everything happening at once for them. And they're kind of sitting back and saying, can we take a break from all these mandates?
Well, one thing I wonder about is, would we be having this? Is $15 the trigger here? Would we be having this conversation? Because I feel like I hear these concerns every time when it goes from $8 to $9, when it goes from $9 to $10. You know what I mean? Is it that we're crossing some dangerous threshold, or is this just what small businesses say every time because anything that cuts into their profits is something they want to resist?
I think there are a few things, Evan, and let's talk about one aspect of it first, where I think we're seeing a direct impact, and that's younger and unskilled workers. We've seen a reduction in younger and unskilled workers. The teen unemployment rate in Massachusetts is three times higher than the regular unemployment rate back in 2016. I think it was almost 10%. You're seeing fewer younger workers. And what happens is when you increase the minimum wage, you are crowding out younger and unskilled workers from the workforce. So fewer teens in the workplace. And one thing we'd certainly like to see this legislative session is something called a teen or training wage. 39 other states in the nation right now have a teen or training wage. Massachusetts is one of 11 states that does not. And what that is a percentage of the minimum wage for a fixed period of time to get younger people into the workforce.
Teens would have a sub-minimum wage. I mean, you see the problem with it, though, which is that it creates an incentive for businesses to hire teens instead of breadwinners, right? If you only have to pay teens $9, but you have to pay a breadwinner $15, then all of a sudden businesses are going to hire more teens and less breadwinners. But that doesn't seem like a great economic outcome.
Well, what happens is that the whole teen training wage, it does only take, you know, 3 months or so of time. So you are essentially talking about summer jobs for kids. You're talking about that kid who wants to work at the pizza shop or over at the lake or something as a lifeguard. And that's what happens. Once you get past that three-month period, the minimum wage goes up to the full rate for people. So you wouldn't be talking about the breadwinners in that case. You'd be talking about the young high school student, the college student trying to make a couple dollars before they go back to school in the summer. And it's something that 39 other states have right now, and Massachusetts is only one of 11 that does not. We're an extreme outlier there.
So, I mean, it does seem still like if we're talking about summer jobs, that would be a lower priority, I think, in terms of thinking about workers and workers' needs.
Well,
than
it is and it isn't, because I think what I'm hearing from a lot of my members often is they'll call and say that workers don't have those soft skills anymore, like how to show up on time, how to dress properly for work. I hear more and more stories from business owners saying that the first jobs these kids are getting are when they're in their 20s now.
I mean, the problem with talking about kids is like it's true that about half of people earning the minimum wage are between 16 and 25. But that also means half of people earning the minimum wage are adults over 25 who need to make money for things other than, well, I don't know, whatever teens need money for from their summer job. It's a whole different affair. They're keeping households together and whatnot. And I think sort of that's the rationale behind the push to raise the minimum wage and the fight for 15.
Well, part of the problem with that, too, is though when you are raising the minimum wage, there have been studies. Mercatus Institute did a study to show when you do increase the minimum wage, it does have an effect on younger workers, and you see fewer opportunities in the workplace. Even Seattle has shown in some of the studies out there that there are fewer hours available. So as we increase the minimum wage and people think they might be having a higher take-home pay because they're getting paid more per hour, there are fewer hours available.
So, I mean, we could play the, like, pick a study game.
My read
of the evidence is that we've got three decades of studies of minimum wage, and mostly what they show is that when you raise the minimum wage, you know, within a reasonable band, that the effect on employment is really small. It's either non-existent or it's small. What I find interesting about the fight for 15 is we may be getting outside that band. That's why I asked you earlier if, like, maybe this is a $15 thing as opposed to let's raise the minimum wage, because this is relatively new territory.
I think another thing we have to consider here, and maybe to go outside the topic of studies, I get a lot of call from my members from different industries. NFIB, we represent all sorts of industries from retail to manufacturing. I got a call the other day from a small restaurant down in southeastern Massachusetts, and she's really struggling to understand how she's going to pay for this. And her solution is, I might just close the shop early. And I was thinking of retiring in 10 years with all the labor costs. I might close down in the next two. The other one, I got a call from someone who hires a lot of teenagers, younger workers. It's a skating rink, and she's seriously considering closing early, retiring, or selling the business. So I get quite a few calls like that. And I guess the last thing I would bring up, You know, I received a call from a member who has a liquor store and a small cafe out in kind of the northwest part of the state. And that economy out there is very different than Boston. What might fly for $15 an hour in Boston doesn't in other parts of the state.
And there's an argument that I think other states have been more sensitive to. As I recall, in New York, they're raising the wage to $15 in the city and in some counties, but not all over the state because they acknowledge regional differences.
Correct. There are areas of the country that have gone to regional. And you've also seen in some of those regions, San Francisco is a good example. A lot of those restaurants moved from San Francisco right across the bridge to an area that did not have the $15 minimum wage. So it does have an impact on how people do business.
Well, that's Chris Carlozzi, the Massachusetts State Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which represents more than 5,000 businesses statewide. Thanks for coming in, Chris.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz.
One hot day in Old Fall River, Mr. Andrew Borden died, and they booked his daughter Lizzie on a charge of homicide. Some folks say she didn't do it, others say of course she did, but they all agree Miss Lizzie B was quite a problem kid, 'cause you can't chop your papa up in Massachusetts, not even...
No, you can't chop your papa up in Massachusetts. In case you didn't recognize it, the infamous she there is Lizzie Borden, the main suspect in the 1892 axe murders of Andrew and Abby Borden, her father and her stepmother, right here in Fall River, Massachusetts. Lizzie was actually acquitted of those murders. Popular lore has been less forgiving, but maybe it's time we open our hearts and minds to the possibility that maybe she didn't do it. At least that's the question behind episode one of the Travel Channel's newest series, Legend Hunter, featuring scientist, adventurer, and North Andover resident Pat Spain, who is sitting next to me now in the studio, and we've only seen on TV before this. Very exciting. How you doing, Pat?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
No, it's great to have you here. But before we dive into the Borden case, I do want to ask more generally about the series Legend Hunter.
Sure, yeah. Right?
7 episodes about different historical modern mysteries, Jack the Ripper, reports of a werewolf in Wisconsin. And the idea, I guess, is you're using mainstream science to kind of pick out some loose ends, pull on them, see what you find.
Exactly. Kind of re-examine these cases with kind of a new perspective and using modern equipment and modern just methods.
But you're a biologist.
I am, yeah. Actually, so a marine biologist.
Okay, okay.
So I'm way
well,
out
now,
of my league.
Now it makes total sense. No, so how did you get into this? What are you doing?
It's a very good question. My wife asks me that almost every day. So, yeah, I started with marine bio and I just love all of the mystery of it, especially the deep ocean. And I was the kid who was catching every animal you could get a hold of when, you know, I raised venomous snakes in the basement and lied to my parents about what they were. I bred poisonous spiders.
You raised venomous snakes?
Oh, yeah. Every parent's dream. Just what you want.
I hope my kids are not listening.
I've got 2 kids now, and I catch snakes with my daughter all the time. And we're out. Yeah, it drives my... Yeah, again, my
and
wife
it's a family
is a very
tradition,
patient woman.
Your esoteric legend
yeah,
hunting.
Yeah, so my great-great-uncle was this man, Charles Fort. Who, if you know the Fortean Society or the Fortean Times, kind of this one of the earliest paranormal and anomalous phenomena researchers. He coined the term teleportation. He invented that term.
Wow.
He was the first to document raining fish and ball lightning, which are scientific phenomena that do happen but were laughed at the time. So yeah, he's a family
right,
member.
So you're keeping up the family tradition.
Absolutely.
So let's talk Lizzie Borden.
Sure.
Her father, her stepmother. Murdered by being chopped up with an axe.
Hatchet.
Yep. We heard
no,
the song.
That's all right.
We heard
yeah.
the song. It was a sensation at the time, right, covered by the press, and
yes.
widely thought to be, I thought, just an open and shut case. But the courts found her not guilty, and you say maybe they were right.
Yeah, so it's really a fascinating case. There's a lot more to it than kind of what's come down in popular lore. And as you said, it just seems like this open and shut case. Like, she was in the house, she had access, you know, and then you hear all of these horror stories about her. Like, oh, she tortured animals, and she was a cold, unforgiving woman, and, you know, all this just awful
stuff
about her.
She cut off a cat's head.
Yeah, so this is the rumor.
I'm not saying she did. That's what
that
I've heard.
And yeah. then when you start really... So what I decided to do is look at this case, you know, with just purely the facts. Like, take this from the start and really look at what we know to be factually true. And I found that all of that noise wasn't real. There's no documented evidence. No, she had very close friends in her life, people who loved her, said she was a warm and caring person. She started the Humane Society of Fall River.
So, and that's afterwards.
Yeah.
Right? She's acquitted of the murders. She goes on to found the Humane Society.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But just this fascinating woman and, you know, really kind of ahead of her time in a lot of the ways that she thought about things. And these stories about her are almost like this. You think about it like a smear campaign of these people coming out. And when you actually read where these stories come from, it's, you know, my best friend's mom's sister said that her aunt heard that Lizzie cut off a cat's head. And now it comes down, you know, in 2019 as, oh, yeah, Lizzie did this.
So, but you acknowledge, I mean, so in some ways you go looking for a better candidate for the
sure.
murder. You're
yeah.
like, well, maybe it could be this person, maybe that person. You acknowledge in some way that she, Lizzie, is the person with the clearest combination of motive, means, and opportunity. That is, you don't get to the point where you're ready to acquit her.
I don't want to give it away
100%. Okay.
I do have a problem with the motive. The motive that everyone points to is that, you know, he was about to give away all of this land that was going to be this huge inheritance of hers, and it really wasn't. It really wasn't that big a deal to her. Like, this wasn't land that she had any emotional attachment to. It wasn't really worth all that much money. It's not a motive to kill in such a brutal way your father and your stepmother. So I kind of removed that from it. But then as I'm looking at the investigation, it really pointed me towards a number of different people, as you said, and some new suspects that hadn't been raised before. But yeah, I mean, it happened a long time ago. It's really hard to definitively
say. Right,
it's
hard to find facts from 1892.
Yeah.
I mean, just to give people a sense of like where detective work was then. The first volume of Sherlock Holmes stories came out in 1892.
Right,
like, the very
exactly.
idea of being a detective is new.
No,
I
yes.
mean, they have historically detectives, but that kind of sleuthing.
Yeah, yeah, like really like digging into the keeping a crime scene, for instance, like was not something that people thought of. Like, people were traipsing through the house, you know, people are coming in and out, and yeah, they weren't collecting fingerprints.
So one thing I think the show does really well is that you're real with your viewers when you hit a dead end, right? Mm-hmm. So for instance, one early suspect you look into is Lizzie's sister, Emma. Right? Mm-hmm. She has this alibi. She's seen 15 miles away in a town of Fairhaven the day of the murders. And you want to find out, you know, could she have gotten there? So you find some guy with a carriage, and I'd love to hear that story too, but some guy with a horse and carriage,
yep.
and you go test it out. And, well, let's play a clip from this.
We've just hit 20 miles per hour. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I can imagine this would also attract a little attention at midday through the city.
Yes.
Whoa!
Yes. It's not riding like a Cadillac.
That's perfect. Perfect. Yeah, I think we're good.
All right, Pepper, walk, buddy. Walk.
Well done, Peppa.
20 miles an hour is pretty rough on the horse and the passengers. You couldn't sustain that for an hour.
So I like that. I mean, because there's something honest about it. You're not hedging. You're not saying, well, maybe she could have run. You're saying, no, actually, we tried this out. It didn't work. Is that part of the idea behind the show?
Absolutely. That's why it's so important to get in the field. With all of the work that I do, you know, from a marine biologist working with animals to investigating these myths and legends, it's so important to get in the field and test your theories and see. Because could a horse run this? Yes. Theoretically, it's possible. A horse that has trained like a marathon runner and a person who has
done
this. A
couple of triple crown winning
yeah,
horses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, can a person run a 4-minute mile? Yeah, a lot of people can. Can I? No. No, I cannot.
The other thing that's great is you have contact with like the living side of these dead stories, right? You find people who are still obsessed with them.
Yeah.
You find relatives of people who were involved in the case. And then you visit the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast Museum, which is in the house where the murders took place.
Yes, it is.
And I particularly would just want to play because I love this exchange where you're exploring the house with the owner, Leanne Wilbur, and you walk into the bedroom where the stepmother's body was found on the floor, and then you have this exchange.
People stay in the room.
It is the most popular room in the house, and a lot of people actually ask, do we mind if they sleep on the floor?
Wow.
Yeah.
The Borden house has become a ghoulish theme park. And of course, there's a gift shop.
I mean, this really is just a testament to what an industry this has become and what a tourist destination.
So is this part of the idea also is to connect what remains of these old cases with the reality of what happened then, or how they've lived on? Or
we had this ongoing conversation with Travel Channel and with the production company, you know, about when is it too soon to kind of take one of these cases? I mean, two people were brutally murdered, but how can we take this and present it in a way where it's not quite as dark and as you know, it's finding that point in time, and it seemed like 100 years seems like that point where it's not too soon. We can talk about
maybe
this now.
We can go visit the gift shop. The floor.
Yeah, I don't understand why. So take it if people want to sleep on the floor, but why do you ask? Why do you ask the person if that's okay? You're renting the room.
Well, that's Pat Spain, scientist, adventurer, and North Andover resident, also the host of the Travel Channel's new series, Legend Hunter, which premieres next Tuesday at 10. More information is available on our website at radioboston.org. Thanks so much, Pat.
Thank you. This was awesome.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.